Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. In a little over a month, 600,000 people from across the globe are expected to converge in Brazil for the World Cup. During the Sochi Winter Games in Russia, stories of cheap labor, the displacement of locals, environmental damage, corruption, and the game's $50 billion price tag revealed the hidden truth behind the global mega sporting event. In Brazil, tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets to protest the upcoming World Cup, which is estimated to cost $15 billion. It'll be more expensive than all previous World Cups combined. So why are people in Brazil protesting the games? In his new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy, the nation's sports editor Dave Zirin traveled to Brazil to find out why people are on the streets. He writes, quote, "When I traveled to Brazil, most people in the community of social movements agreed that these sports extravaganzas would leave behind major collateral damage. What people disagreed upon was whether anybody would do anything about it," end quote. So what are the real human costs of these global sporting events beyond the spectacle? Today, we're joined by Dave Zirin, sports editor with The Nation magazine and author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. He hosts the weekly Sirius XM show, Edge of Sports Radio. And in addition to talking about what's happening in Brazil, we will also talk about efforts to unionize college athletes. And of course, we can't talk with Dave without talking about the Clippers owner, Donald Sterling. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Dave, why don't we start off by talking about Donald Sterling and his racist remarks? There have been so many reactions coming from players and so many people in the media. This is not the first time he's faced racism charges, but it is the first time that many people have heard his name. So what was your reaction when this exploded?
First of all, utterly unsurprised because, you know, I've been writing about Donald Sterling and his racist practices for about 8 years. He was a chapter in a book I wrote called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. So his practices are very well known, practices both inside the NBA and in his business as a slumlord in the greater Los Angeles area. He had to pay the largest settlement in the history of the Fair Housing Act for housing discrimination. And he was sued by his own general manager, former general manager Elgin Baylor, for racial discrimination. So no surprises whatsoever. I suppose if there was any surprise, it was the ferocity of the reaction on pretty much by everybody. I mean, whether you're talking about sponsors, whether you're talking about players, whether you're talking about other owners, I mean, this clearly was one of those situations where everybody realized immediately how toxic Donald Sterling was for the brand of NBA basketball, and right at the start of the NBA playoffs when the money really does start coming in.
Why do you think the NBA ignored his history of racism? I mean, it took a leaked phone call or a conversation that he had with, I don't know what you describe her, some have written mistress, young girlfriend. Anyway, it took a leaked conversation for the organization to finally step in.
Well, that's a great question to ask of someone who hasn't really commented so far, and that would be David Stern. David Stern, the former commissioner of the National Basketball Association, he just retired after a 30-year tenure. Almost year for year, he was the NBA commissioner as Donald Sterling was the owner of the Clippers. So we're talking 30 years of incidents, 30 years of comments, and 30 years of a whole lot of smoke. And yet each and every time, they ignored the possibility that this might someday turn into a fire. So that's really a question for David Stern. If I had to guess why that's the case, I think it's much more has to do with, frankly, ownership culture in sports, which is the profound double standard that says that players need to be monitored, players need to be policed, players' dress code needs to be looked after, particularly players of color, particularly African-American players. And this hyper-surveillance approach towards the players, and hyper-judgmentalism, if that's a word, towards the players, is something that's never reflected on ownership, no matter how badly these men behave.
Well, and it is interesting because most media reports did focus on the statistics. So you've got about a 3/4 of basketball players are black. The majority of the owners are white, but a lot of coaches are black. Is that right?
Yeah, and when we say majority of owners are white, I mean, we're talking, there is one African-American owner, one Indian owner, as in South from India, South Asian. And other than that, all the owners are white. So we're talking 28 out of 30 owners are white males, and players 75%. And it is true that when it does come to head coaching positions, the NBA is absolutely positively miles ahead of the other leagues. If anything, if the NBA has any kind of prejudice when it comes to coaching, it's prejudicial in favor of former point guards as opposed to former centers, which is why you see oftentimes point guards like Doc Rivers, Mark Jackson squaring off in the playoffs, yet someone like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Patrick Ewing have never gotten a chance to be head coaches in the NBA.
What really struck you about the comments? Michael Jordan came out and issued a statement saying, as a current owner and a former player, I'm disgusted that a fellow team owner could hold such sickening and offensive views. But I've read that Michael Jordan has been pretty quiet for most of his career about politics and especially racism within the NBA and sports in general.
Oh, boy, that's an understatement. I mean, Michael Jordan is one of the most aggressively apolitical athletes to ever live. And not only that, because of his greatness on the court and his greatness as a commercial brand, he has been profoundly influential for a whole generation of athletes about not being political. Now, I've been arguing for the last several years that that wheel has turned somewhat, particularly in the advent of social media, where players have easier access to make their political views known, that we're turning away from that whole sort of children of Jordan approach where everybody's like Michael Jordan and says Republicans buy sneakers too and you don't want to rock the boat. You see a lot more boat rocking taking place. And in this particular case, I mean, you had, for example, LeBron James, who's the number one NBA superstar, come out with very strong language about Donald Sterling before the fallout was even known, before one sponsor had backed away. And then the fact that Michael Jordan himself felt the need to say something. I mean, my goodness. I mean, that says more about Donald Sterling's odiousness than anything else. Like, if you're so odious that you actually provoke Michael Jordan to speak out, well, that really says something about you.
Well, you know, and Dave, every time you're on the show, we always talk about whether these sports stars have a responsibility to focus on these issues because they have such a massive platform. So in the case of Michael Jordan, do you think someone like him deserves credit for finally speaking out? Or I was reading over at the Black Agenda report, you know, they said, forget it. The guy hasn't spoken out on other issues that have been just as bad. We don't think he deserves credit.
I mean, credit only comes to me. I don't care if you're talking about athletes. I don't care if you're talking about my next door neighbor. I mean, credit should really only come if somebody's risking something by standing up for principle. And in this case, it became clear very quickly that the only real risk would be if owners did nothing. I mean, you have sponsors fleeing in droves. You have players talking about going on wildcat strikes and walking off the court. You have the President of the United States, for goodness sake, speaking about it in Malaysia. I mean, we reached a kind of tipping point where the real risk by owners would have been in saying nothing. I mean, frankly, the only owner, and I'm not saying this to credit him because it's a terrible position to take, but the only owner who really risked anything in this Sterling saga was Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, who said he wasn't comfortable banning Sterling from the sport because he said it sounds like a slippery slope. Are we going to start banning owners if they're homophobic or if they're sexist or for their business practices? And to that answer, I would be like, yes, yes, and yes. That sounds like a great idea. But that was risky for him to say that because the real risk was for saying nothing. So it's like I don't see why I or anyone would feel compelled to credit Jordan for speaking out. I more credit players like Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors, who organized the team to walk off the court if this ban hadn't happened last Tuesday night.
What do you think this reveals about just the economics of these sports franchises? Because according to reports, the Clippers is worth about $575 million. People are saying it could sell for up to $700 million. This is for one franchise, one team. So talk to us a little bit about the economics of these teams. And that's the other thing that's raising eyebrows is for people who don't follow this very closely, they see that $500 to $700 million number and they think, wow, I just didn't know so much money was involved in this.
I mean, I think they could get close to $1 billion for this franchise.
Wow.
I mean, when you consider that the Warriors sold just a couple of years ago for between $500 and $600 million. And all these franchises are starting to sell for more and more money because of it has to do with the recent collective bargaining agreement, which was signed in 2011, which tilted very favorably to the owners. And it has to do with what they think is going to be an explosion of people being using their computer devices and various screens to be able, on a global sense, to do pay-per-view of NBA games. Any game, anywhere, long as you have a Wi-Fi connection, you're watching the NBA. And the players are largely cut out of that future cash flow, which is why, unlike a couple of years ago when there were several teams on the market, now every time a team's on the market, there's a line of people to buy the franchise. The other part of this that people should know is that Donald Sterling bought this team for under $13 million and only paid $3 million down and put the rest on layaway. And now it's worth close to $1 billion. Now, why is that interesting? Because if you actually suffered through listening to his audio recording, there's this part in it where he sounds like the worst kind of 1%er, with a huge dose of racism on top of it, where he talks at length about how he clothes his players, he feeds his players, and if it wasn't for him and the owners, the players would have nothing, as if people for the last 30 years have been showing up to watch him sit on the sideline, as opposed to watching Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Larry Bird, et cetera. I mean, the league has exploded in size because of an unimaginable bumper crop of talent over the last three decades. And Donald Sterling has nothing to do with that, yet he's more than willing to take credit for it.
So given Donald Sterling's past, do you think the NBA would have taken action if the players' union didn't threaten to strike during the playoffs?
Well, two things about that, and I just to be clear about some of the language here. The players' union is in pretty terrible disarray. They currently don't have an executive director. The president, Chris Paul, is on the Clippers, which put him in a position where he looked about as uncomfortable as, my goodness, as just about anybody. And he looked as, I'm trying to think of the right metaphor, like a Muslim in a Colorado Springs megachurch is what Chris Paul looked like. I mean, just like he looked like, what am I going to do here? I'm supposed to lead this team. I'm freaking out. And it was a very difficult situation for Chris Paul. So it was less the union doing it and more the players themselves. I mean, the best word to describe it would be a wildcat type situation, because the players were self-organizing to walk off the court. And the amazing thing, if they had done this, is that, my goodness, I mean, I don't think the NBA would have punished them for it, even though it would have cost them millions of dollars. Think about the sponsorship dollars lost. Think about the embarrassment. Think about the television time they would owe ABC, TNT, ESPN, whoever was broadcasting the games. But I think the NBA was so over the barrel on this and in such horrible public relations territory, they really had no choice. They had no choice whatsoever but to do what the players wanted. And there's been a lot of debate amongst my circle of people and also amongst the broader community in sort of like sports radio land about whether the players would have actually walked off the court or whether this was just kind of like an empty threat. And I think the better way to understand it is that the threat of a strike is a time-honored tactic in labor management relations. And we know for sure, I know for sure based on my sources, that Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, was very, very aware that that threat was on the table.
We're speaking with Dave Zirin, the sports editor for The Nation magazine. He hosts the weekly SiriusXM show Edge of Sports Radio, and he's out with a new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. And if you have a question or a comment for Dave about what's going on in the sports world, we'd love to hear from you. If you've been following the controversy over Donald Sterling, what are your thoughts on this and how the NBA handled it? We're also going to talk about efforts to unionize college athletes, and then we'll talk about what's happening in Brazil. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, if you have any questions about the economics of sports, again, Dave just said that the Clippers could be bought for $1 billion, just one franchise. So we're talking about a lot of money in sports. We've talked to Dave in the past about subsidized stadiums, and in Northern California, of course, that's such a hot topic. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. I wanted to also talk about these efforts to unionize college athletes. A couple weeks ago, Northwestern football players cast secret ballots on whether to form the nation's first union for college athletes. It could take some time for them to know the results because the university has challenged these efforts. First off, Dave, how significant is this?
Oh, my goodness. This is, you know, there's a tendency, particularly in sports journalism, although as I know you're aware, Rose, its existence in the mainstream media is very prevalent as well, but it's to overhype the story and for the purposes of, you know, pushing people's various emotion reflexes, get the page views, clickbait, get people turning in. Yet every so often we have these stories that are bigger than the media is making them out to be, that are actually more significant, and we don't recognize those as we should. And there's so many examples of that as well, although they tend to be very rare in the sports world because the tendency is to always overhype everything. This is one of those instances where you could not be loud enough about trumpeting this story. I mean, because this, and it's not dissimilar from the Sterling story in that, I mean, what the common thread here is that this is about athletes taking control of their own lives. Athletes not willing to be seen as just extensions of equipment. Athletes saying, we may have bodies, but we also have voices. We also have minds, and we demand a seat at the table. That's what's happened at Northwestern University. The players, right now it's under appeal, but players at Northwestern are now recognized by the federal government as workers, and their coaches recognized as their boss. They took a union vote. We may not know for months what the result of that vote was, and that's the fault of Northwestern University, which is appealing this to every court in the land. I mean, they're going to appeal this thing to Judge Judy in the People's Court if they have to. And they're going to put $250 million, the NCAA, I should say,
wow,
with Northwestern in legal fees to stop this from happening. Because as they say, the NCAA says this, they say this is a threat to the current system of college athletics. It could blow up the entire system. That's a direct quote of Mark Emmert, the head of the NCAA. And when he says this could blow up college athletics, my response, I swear to you, as soon as I heard this, Rose, I had a two-word response in my head. It was, you promise? Because the NCAA should be blown up. It is an utterly immoral system. And the interesting thing, Rose, you may be familiar with the radio station KNBR, the sports radio station in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you listen to it every day.
No.
I bet you have family members who do.
Oh, yeah.
I was on a KNBR show. I'm going to choose to not name the host. And he said something that I have heard in other instances. He was having me explain the Northwestern situation, the players organizing. And he said to me, you know what, if we'd been having this conversation 5 years ago, I would have called you a lefty meathead who has no idea what they're talking about, and these players should be lucky just to get a scholarship. But I just don't feel that way anymore. The system's just gotten too big, too corrupt, and the players are just too screwed over. And I'm hearing that from a lot of people whose tendency would be to be anti-student, anti-worker, whatever you want to say. But even for them, this just feels a little too icky. I mean, Northwestern has a coach who makes $2.5 million a year. He's the highest paid person on the Northwestern campus. And if you go back 20 years to when their coach was a guy named Dennis Green, he made, I believe, I looked it up, he made like $90,000 a year. So the salaries have gone up so dramatically for the head coaches. I mean, Mike Krzyzewski, the coach at Duke, makes $9.7 million a year.
Wow.
You know, and that's not even his Nike money. Mm. And here are the player and here are the players running up and down the court wearing their Nike gear. They don't see a cent. And the important part of this, the reason why people like this KNBR host are shifting on it, is that the demands of college athletes are greater than they've ever been before. They're asked to travel more. They're asked to do more. And yet, once again, they don't see anything for it. They don't even get guaranteed 4-year scholarships. So this is a huge story. It's about powerlessness and power. It's about labor organizing, and it's about the resolve of some very, very brave young people on the Northwestern campus.
And how are these coaches able to make so much money? I mean, does it come from television deals and, you know, like T-shirts and things that are sold and then ticket prices? I mean, where does most of the money come from?
Well, the money comes from a couple of sources. It comes from athletic department revenue. It comes from, which of course in turn is directly related to the amount of television revenue that's able to come in as well. And that's been the change in the last 30 years. I mean, the legendary coach, John Wooden, who, you know, he coached into the 1970s at UCLA, won 10 championships in 12 years. I believe he retired in 1975. I looked up his salary his last year there, 1975, which is a long time ago, but not a crazy long time ago. And he made $35,000.
Wow.
1975. Fast forward to today. And like I said, Mike Krzyzewski, $9.7 million. And where is that all come from? This has been generated by both March Madness, that's the NCAA college basketball tournament, which really took off in earnest in the early 80s, and college football money, which is amazingly huge. I mean, they just signed a $7 billion contract for the college playoffs with ESPN. $7 billion. And so you have here, and this is the way I've written about it, so if people have read this, I apologize for repeating myself, but I think it's the best way to explain it. The problem at work here, Rose, is that you have two economic systems existing side by side inside one structure. You have a go-go free market rock and roll kind of atmosphere for the coaches, where they jump from school to school. They're constantly trying to get more money, jumping from place to place. They're able to leverage whatever they can leverage to be able to get those high salaries. And then you've got the players who are in a position that what can only really be described as indentured servitude, where they're bound to a campus. They're not allowed to sell their autograph. They're not allowed to sell their image. They're not even allowed to, say, play over the summer in a summer league and get a few extra dollars that way. They're not allowed to do anything. I mean, if you're on campus with, say, an orchestra scholarship, you can play in a band over the summer and get paid. You know, all these other kinds of scholarships. Hell, if you're on a journalism scholarship, you can write freelance articles during the year and get paid. You know, but for players, they are bound. And that's why the term indentured servitude, which some think is sharp, is actually very descriptive. So you've got indentured servitude and the wolfiest wolves of Wall Street existing in the same structure. And, you know, Abe Lincoln said, a house divided cannot stand. So that's the central contradiction that's pulling the NCAA apart right now.
And, Dave, we have to go to break quickly, but in 30 seconds, how do college athletes feel about unionizing?
Oh, I mean, they all feel like they're getting screwed over. I've never met a college athlete who off the record has said to me, you know what, the system really works. But as far as how they feel about unionizing, there are a lot of mixed feelings about that. But that's worth, maybe we should talk about that after the break.
Yeah, let's do that.
Kind of a difficult discussion, but
yeah,
let's talk about it.
And I'd love to also ask you, I mean, what is the just way to run college sports? We'll talk about that after the break. We're speaking today with Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and author of the new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and The Fight for Democracy. Coming up after the break, we will talk about the fight to unionize college athletes, and then we'll also talk about what is happening in Brazil. In just over a month, 600,000 people from across the globe are expected to converge in Brazil for the World Cup, and tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets to protest. It's expected to cost $15 billion. Dave traveled to Brazil to find out why people are on the streets, and he'll tell us what he heard right after this.
You are listening to Your Call on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. Good morning, David LaTulip here with Matt Martin, taking just a moment out of the normal calling time for Your Call on this, an opening day of sorts of our public radio party. Nice to have Dave Zirin on our opening day.
Yeah, it's great. Dave is a good person to have at a party. Pretty interesting person if you ever ran into him at a party. You want to talk about sports and get a whole different angle on it. That's the kind of conversation that you get on Your Call, that we are celebrating the truth-telling, the independence, and the information information. Your support makes it possible.
800-525-9917. Join the Public Radio Party at 800-525-9917 or make that pledge online at kalw.org. With any donation that you make during this Public Radio Party, we're going to invite you to our in-person Public Radio Party on June 11th, 2014. It's a Wednesday evening, June 11th at City College here in the Mission District. For any donation, you'll join in a physical party with the folks that have contributed just like you.
I don't know how physical it's going to get, but it's going to be a lot of fun. 800-525-9917. And we also have a challenge in this hour. Cherie Rassidi of San Francisco has said if 20 people join the party, support KALW, new members, returning members, people giving a little extra something, if 20 people will do that, she'll put forward an additional $500 for local public radio. Make your support go further. 800-525-9917.
Join the Public Radio Party online as well at kalw.org. Any click or call will count towards this special challenge. We can do that this hour during your call and special guest Dave Zirin. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. Thanks to the folks who are on the line right now. You can join them or go online to kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Ralph Nader. He's out with a new book called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. So we will talk with Ralph Nader about the many decades that he spent in Washington, D.C., working with the left and the right. And we'll talk about how things have changed and whether or not he's invited to testify on Capitol Hill post-2000 election. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about a new book called Talks In, Talks Out. We will talk about chemicals and how we can keep them out of our bodies. What are the biggest concerns and what do you want to know about all of the chemicals we're exposed to on a regular basis? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine. We're talking with Dave about the controversy over the Clippers owner Donald Sterling. Dave says that if the franchise is sold, it could go for up to $1 billion. We're also talking about efforts to unionize college athletes, and we'll talk about his experience in Brazil to find out why so many people have taken to the streets to protest the upcoming World Cup. It's estimated to cost $15 billion, more than all previous World Cups combined. And Dave is out with a new book about his travels to Brazil and what's going on there. It's called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. Dave says that athletic mega events have turned into neoliberal Trojan horses. So if you have a question or a comment for Dave, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're going to go to calls in just a minute, but I wanted to finish your thought on college sports. What is the just way, do you think, Dave, to run college sports?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think it starts with recognizing that in the revenue-producing sports, particularly in each college, but this is a different question, but in most colleges we're talking about men's football and men's basketball and sometimes women's basketball as well, depending on the school, that at these schools, these are campus employees, and they need to be treated as such. That means they're entitled to workers' compensation if they get hurt. That means that they have the right to be able to have a seat at the table and determine their traveling arrangements. And that means they have the right to have input into how their lives are controlled. And I think that's got to be the most basic starting point for when we discuss this. And then everything needs to flow from that. Because otherwise, you're dealing with just the kind of rank hypocrisy and complete absence of any sort of moral center in what we're talking about. And I think that that's how we begin.
Well, let's hear from callers. Let's go to Meg in Monterey County. Hi, Meg. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for taking my call and great conversation, Rose, Dave. You know, I was listening to everything that you were talking about when it came to the Clippers and what's gone on there. And I have to tell you that, I mean, when I was watching all of that, I just kept thinking, they're not going far enough. They have, at this point, right now, they have the world in their hands. People are watching them. They're supportive of them. They're supportive of the team and across the board. And they did show solidarity very quickly by going to the game. They put their jerseys in the center of the court. But I think they should have gone farther. And I do think that they would have been willing to walk out, because in the end, it's money that speaks to these owners. It isn't much about the player. These players are like a commodity to them. So, I don't believe that they went farther, and they should have asked for several things. One, they should have asked, that, for example, the cap that he's being hit on, which is 2.5, which is nothing.
$2.5
million. Yeah, they should have asked for a voice on the board of the owners. They should have asked to have a say in their future. And I still believe that they should have gone farther. And I think that there's a bigger question that nobody is really asking, and that is that when it comes to the conversation, he keeps saying, don't do this stuff, I'm getting calls, or I'm being told, you could do it in private, but just don't do it in front of everybody. And so the bigger question is, who are all these others that are complicit? And, because I think that the NAACP in itself has been complicit to what's gone on here.
Well, thank you for calling in, Meg. Dave, how do you think this should have been dealt with?
Okay, that's a lot of interesting stuff raised from that last caller. Let me just unpack some of it. First and foremost, did the players go far enough? You've heard from a lot of circles, particularly a lot of left circles, that they should have gone farther, that they should have evoked much more of the militancy of people like Muhammad Ali, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, Billie Jean King. And I'm not necessarily in that camp, because I thought the way the players handled it was smart. They did their symbolic gesture. They waited for the review by the NBA just to make sure that the tape was actually authentic. The NBA, they did need to do an authentication process, because can you imagine if all this had happened and it turned out to be an elaborate hoax? I mean, you have to really watch yourself sometimes before you leap. And they were prepared to walk. So it's like it's such a weird thing, because it's like they were prepared to make this radical act if their demands weren't met, but they were willing to give it 72 hours. And everybody wanted, like, within 12 hours, everybody just to walk, walk, walk. But there's a lot more that goes into it than that, not the least of which is, and this is something that a point that John Carlos made from the 1968 Olympics. I called John Carlos up just to ask his thoughts on all this. And John pointed out to me, he said, it's not as easy as just making a stand. Like, you need to organize all 12 players. And the 12 players might have very different perspectives, very different politics. And so the fact that they were able to get all 12 players on board to throw their uniforms at center court before that one game and to get them ready to walk out Tuesday if their demands weren't met, I mean, I thought all together in full, it was a showcase of some very effective organizing. But it's the sort of thing that, that I think everybody wants the dramatic big-time moment, and count me among them. I think that would have been an unbelievable historical moment if they'd all walked off the court. They were going to wait until after the opening tip. So the ball was going to go up, and then they were just going to turn around and walk. Mm. I mean, that would have been an amazing thing to see. It also would have come with a tremendous amount of risk. I would also just say, now that's the first thing to unpack. The second thing is, you talked about the NAACP. And, yes, it is still absolutely shocking that the Los Angeles chapter of the NAACP was going to give Donald Sterling his second Lifetime Achievement Award.
And for people who haven't followed this part of this story, can you give us a little background on this? Why were they going to give him a Lifetime Achievement Award?
And before I do, Rose, I just want to make very clear to folks,
sure,
that just so they know this, that the NAACP, I mean, its chapters tend to operate in a highly autonomous fashion. Mm-hmm. So when everybody's like, how could the NAACP do this, people really have to be specific and say, how could the L.A. chapter of the NAACP do this? Because it's really, for any criticisms people might have of the NAACP, and if you have them, bring them on, because they're certainly worth making. You can't sort of attack the entire organization for the actions of this chapter. And now this chapter, Donald Sterling had given, I believe, $3 million to. So he was buying his way out of his own racism, basically, by throwing money at the NAACP, and they were happily accepting it. Because let's be clear about something. Like I said before, that I'd been writing about Donald Sterling's racism for many years, And that's fine and good, because whatever, you know, I wrote about it, big deal. But guess what? ESPN, the magazine, also wrote a big extensive story about this years ago. Other publications, oh, all over the L.A. news. I mean, the Los Angeles Times, for goodness sakes, did a huge expose of Donald Sterling and have done repeated ones over the years. They've done these. Sports Illustrated has done it. So the idea that the NAA and L.A. NAACP was somehow ignorant of Donald Sterling's history is laughable. I mean, if anything, to me, what this exposes and what it shows is, frankly, a lack of a moral compass in the Los Angeles NAACP, and that's, you know, where money solves all evil. And that's exactly why the head of the LA NAACP has already resigned from office. And he was right to resign, because that's absolutely inexcusable. And if people don't understand why it's inexcusable, then you need to actually go to substandard housing in the United States of America. Mm. See how people have to live in this country when a slumlord oversees their housing. It's absolutely shocking, and people need to be shocked if they don't understand why this is such a shame and a sin that Donald Sterling made his money by terrorizing people of color in Los Angeles County.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Meg. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question or comment for Dave Zirin, sports editor with The Nation, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'd like to ask Dave's opinion. What will it take to shine a light on some other odious sports club owners, such as the DeVos family, who own the Orlando franchise in the NBA? They've been a fixture in right-wing politics in Michigan for years, funding candidates, think tanks, and organizations such as ALEC.
Yeah, and also connected by marriage to Blackwater as well, the Prince family and the DeVos family. They're very tied in with Blackwater. I mean, I've been writing about the DeVos family for years. There are other odious owners as well. From James Dolan of the New York Knicks, Aubrey McClendon and Clay Bennett, who own the Oklahoma City Thunder. And in that question, I love that question, but in that question you hear exactly what Mark Cuban was talking about when he raised concerns about the slippery slope and what we actually think of as behavior that's beyond the pale. Because one of the things that Commissioner Adam Silver said when he announced Donald Sterling's lifetime ban is that he didn't say it was just because of the recording. He said it was because of, and this is a quote, Rose, a pattern of behavior. And everybody knows what pattern of behavior means. It means being called on the carpet for being a slumlord and having to pay these settlements to the Justice Department. Mm-hmm. And so if we're going to start looking at how people make their money, that's going to be something that, you know, that old expression, behind every great fortune is a great crime. And a lot of these guys, they don't want their crimes exposed to public view. So to answer the question, it's like, not only is this it's an opportunity on two fronts. One, it's an opportunity to expose how a lot of these owners make their money, which is a way of exposing just the complete moral bereftness of the 1% in the United States. That's one angle. And the second thing is it's an opportunity to raise a broader discussion about racism in sports, particularly the name of the franchise where I live in Washington, D.C., the name of the football franchise, which is named after a racial slur for Native Americans. And it's an opportunity to really ask the question, like, are we really going to have a zero-tolerance policy towards racism in pro sports?
Do you think this conversation will really go anywhere, or do you think that maybe the Clippers will be sold for $1 million and it'll be business as usual, or a billion, I should say, and it'll be business as usual?
Well, it's an open question. I mean, the NBA has acted with alarming speed on this whole issue precisely because they don't want this to be a broader discussion. Mm-hmm. They want to isolate it. They want to quarantine it, if you will. And it's like they want to cut off the arm to save the patient, if you catch my drift. And will they get away with that? I mean, I think on the question of players and players' rights, who really knows? You just never know the degree to which the actions that took place are going to be something that inspires players going forward. I'll tell you this, though, on the question of the Washington football team name, I mean, that they've already not been able to quarantine that. I mean, when you have people like Senator Harry Reid from the well of the Senate, the day after Sterling is banned, giving an impassioned speech about renaming the Washington team name and John McCain calling for renaming the Washington football team. And let me be very clear about this. I am neither a fan of Harry Reid nor John McCain, but it's like one thing they are, that anyone would admit they are political survivors. And the way you become political survivors is you know which way the wind is blowing. So that's very significant to me.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Frank. And let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
The thing I like about sports is that more than any other business, quote unquote, in our society, at least on the players' level, we have a meritocracy, an egalitarian system where players are chosen on their abilities. And that has evolved over the years. But it seems also that it has become a huge distraction in our society. And
sure.
That it takes away from our attention from very significant social, family, and spiritual issues that probably should get more of our attention. And I would like to know what your guest has to think about that.
Hmm. I mean, you know, it's like someone once said to me that they believe that sports is like fire, and you could use fire to cook a meal or fire to burn down a house. And currently, I think the caller makes some good points. You can see the way this fire is burning down the house when people become so hyper-obsessed with sports while our very planet is in peril, for goodness sakes. And you could pick your issue. Yet at the same time, I believe that sports still contains that fire to cook the meal and to nourish us. But it only does that if we're willing, like with fire, to harness it and shape it. So, for example, you know, Rose and I could have pardon the expression, a jackass conversation about Donald Sterling and just sort of talk about what this means for the Clippers in the playoffs and will Chris Paul rise to the occasion, blah, blah, and all that BS, which you could get on any sports radio station. Or we could have a serious discussion about racism in U.S. society, about conditions in slums in Los Angeles County, and about whether or not this is a turning point against Native American mascotry. You see what I'm saying? It's like what do you choose to do with this hyper-focus that folks have about sports? And if you believe, as I do, that sports is rife with politics, whether we choose to see it or not, it's there, then we have an opportunity to engage with that and try to really use it in a way to talk about issues that actually concern people in their day-in, day-out lives.
Well, thank you for calling, John. We're speaking with Dave Zirin, editor of the sports section in The Nation magazine and author of the new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. And let's talk about the trip you took to Brazil, Dave. It's a really interesting book. I mean, again, you know, it's a sports book, but there's so much history about Brazil, so many political angles here. As you write, athletic mega events have turned into neoliberal Trojan horses. And so initially, when you went to Brazil, you were fascinated by how the staging of the World Cup in a dozen cities across the country would differ from the Olympics situated in Rio. You wanted to look at construction projects. You wanted to talk to people on the streets. And then you told your plan to Marcos Alvito, a professor and lecturer with expertise in these issues. And he looked at you for a long time and said, not without kindness, quote, Brazil is not for beginners. And you write that he's right. It's a country of 200 million people on an area larger than the continental United States, possesses the largest economy in the global south and the fifth largest on the planet.
Exactly right. To say that you know Brazil by anybody who is not from Brazil, it really is like saying, I know the United States because you spent some time in New York and San Francisco. I mean, it's like to know Brazil is to know something that, frankly, is unknowable for an outsider because it is so diverse, it is so rich, its history is unbelievable. And so when I was there and tried, like a book project that just started as simple as me saying, hey, the World Cup and the Olympics are going to be in Brazil. I've written about these events in the past. Brazil's an emerging country. That would make a great book. Like, when I got there, I was quickly just disabused that it would be that simple. And it turned into the most challenging project of my life because I realized that the best thing I could do that would be the most helpful would be to write a book that introduces Brazil and its rich history to a U.S. audience. And I'm so proud that we have a U.S. a Brazilian publisher that's publishing it in Portuguese for people in Brazil. And I'm going to be down in Brazil in June, and I'm excited to see what people in Brazil think about the book, because I think they might find it interesting on a very sort of meta level of like, okay, here is how Brazil is explained to people in the United States, you know, and I think, I hope that that's they're in for fascinating. Fortunately, like, people in Brazil who read it, they like the book a lot because the book strongly stands with people who are suffering under the weight of these mega events. I mean, the book is called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, not FIFA's Dance with the devil being Brazil. Not the IOC's Dance with the Devil, it's Brazil's Dance with the Devil. And the devil in this case is the International Olympic Committee and FIFA, the world soccer governing body, because of what they're doing to Brazil. But to understand what they're doing to Brazil and why it matters, you really do have to understand Brazil's unbelievably interesting history, a history that is, in a weird way, like I write in the book, it's either a funhouse mirror of the United States or the United States is a funhouse mirror of Brazil. Because there are so many similarities between the two countries and their origins and foundings, yet the differences are as equally sharp.
Well, and what really strikes you? I mean, we've got a couple minutes left. You have so many interesting stories in your book about the privatization of airports. Brazil has no passenger rail system. You say that Brazil has enough stadiums, so why are they building more? For example, in the northern city of Natal, the stadium they're building looks like a spaceship that came crashing down.
Yes, this is the problem with FIFA and the World Cup, is that you go to a country like Brazil, a country that in many respects defines soccer internationally in terms of style and in terms of substance. They've won more World Cups than any other country. And they say to Brazil, you don't have enough soccer stadiums, which is sort of like going to the United States and saying you don't have enough football stadiums. I mean, it's a wildly stupid thing to say. And it only matters if you have another agenda. And that agenda is about FIFA's agenda of acting in concert with political elites and economic elites to really be that neoliberal Trojan horse and remake the country. And in Brazil, this idea of remaking the country is particularly pungent because Brazil is undergoing, particularly in Rio, a real estate speculative boom right now. But Rio and Brazil also have some of the strongest squatters' rights laws in the world. So this has become a pretext to remove literally thousands upon thousands of people from their land for the purposes of development, all under the pretext of security, the World Cup, and the need to have FIFA-quality stadiums.
200,000 people are supposed to be evicted, right? As a direct
that
result.
That number may spiral.
Wow.
Just like your number, about 15 billion. That number has been upgraded so many times. It's like you need a taxi meter. It was 13 billion a couple of months ago, but
right,
they keep having to revise the numbers. And I guarantee you this, only because this is the history of these mega events, the final numbers will dwarf 15 billion. I promise you that.
And Dave,
because they always do when the dust is cleared.
We have about 30 seconds left. I mean, we did a show about what we saw in Russia, so much displacement, environmental destruction, arrests, evictions, the same thing we're seeing in Brazil. Do you think anything's going to change? Because now with social media, the protesters are getting a lot of attention, and we're all really learning about what you call this neoliberal Trojan horse. Do you see anything changing?
Of course. I mean, the change only begins with awareness. And so maybe this will be a process, maybe this will take some time, but the use of particularly the poorest residents of Brazil, the favelados, the people who live in the favelas, are very social media savvy. And, you know, over about, I think roughly 40% of all favela homes are equipped for Wi-Fi, for goodness sakes. And so, and these are like some of the homes that they're trying to destroy. So people are connected, people are making waves, and people are being heard in a way that's absolutely fascinating. And if I could just say one thing with the little time we have left, I just really want to encourage people to support KALW. There's no question in my mind that I wouldn't even have a frickin' career if it wasn't for people like Rose and for stations like KALW. And so if you really like this resource, but you're just getting it for free, please, please support KALW.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Dave Zirin is author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil. And thank you for listening.
And there is definitely a reason why we invited Dave Zirin to be with us here on Your Call on this first day of our public radio party. I'm Matt Martin, joining Rose Aguilar here in the studio, asking for your support in these final minutes of the hour before we get a world have your say. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. Rose, we have a challenge.
Oh, great.
Cherie Reciti in San Francisco has put forward $500 and says if 20 KALW listeners become members, renew their membership, give a little something extra during this hour, she will add $500 to support the public radio party. Your call or click right now can make it happen. 800-525-9917, KALW.org.
Thank you so much, Cherie Reciti. Now is a really good time to call. If we can get 20 of you to give us a call, we will get $500 more. Thanks to Cherie Reciti. 800-525-9917. For $120, we will send you Dave Zirin's new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil. It's full of really interesting information about what's happening in Brazil. People are being displaced. They're speaking out. Really interesting history also about Brazil, Matt. $120 will send you this really great book. You can go online to kalw.org or give us a call. We have a room full of volunteers. 800-525-9917.
Join this party that's about news, information, ideas, about critical perspectives. And Dave Zirin, we've had him on the program a number of times. We used to say, oh, he's America's premier, you know, political sports writer. He's the only sports writer who has a social justice perspective. He's a great writer. He is one of those people who can talk about sports from what's happening on the floor to what's happening in the boardrooms. That perspective is what we hope to bring to you on KALW. You make it possible.
800-525-9917. We'll definitely get Dave back when he's in Brazil covering the World Cup. You can also go online to kalw.org. $120, we will send you Dave's new book. And thanks to a challenge from Cherie Reciti, if 20 of you give us a call, we will get $500 more that'll push us towards our goal, and it would be a great way to start the first day of our KALW party.
800-525-9917. Ivan Mendenhall in San Francisco. Diane Jackson, also in the city. Stephanie Seacrest in Alameda. All people we want to thank for making the decision to become members. These are new members of KALW today. Join them. If you've never done it before, maybe you listen to Rose and you're calling, you go, man, I just learned something when I tune in at 10 o'clock on a weekday. Here is where you make it happen. At any level of support, not only will we thank you, we will invite you to a real-life party June 11th. That's a Wednesday evening in the Mission in San Francisco. Come out and meet Rose and all the folks from KALW and celebrate local public radio.
800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org. Volunteers are on the phone. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
For calling. For a $120 contribution, we'll send you Dave Zirin's new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil. And when we reach 20 listeners in the next couple of minutes, we'll get an extra $500 for KALW. 800-525-9917. And I understand we're getting a lot of new members this morning,
Matt. It's been a great morning in terms of people making that decision to be involved. And remember, it can be being a new member of KALW. Maybe you've come from another city and you recognize this is my station in the Bay Area. Now is your time to show your support. We've got a great comment from Kim Pereira Cawthorn in San Lorenzo. Renewed her membership. She said, I feel your radio station contributes to making the Bay Area a smarter and better place to live. Kim, you have done that by making the decision to support this station. Won't you join Kim? Join the public radio party.
Thank you, Kim. 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org. And be sure to mark your calendar. It's June 11th in San Francisco. And if you call us now, 800-525-9917, hopefully we'll reach that 20 mark and we'll get an extra $500 thanks to a challenge from Cherie Reciti. 800-525-9917. And if you are maybe just found KALW, we rely on you. Our show, Your Call, receives no money from corporate sponsors. We are completely funded by you. 800-525-9917.
Thank you for your support for KALW San Francisco. Thanks to everyone who's calling. You still have time as we go to the BBC and World Have Your Say.
Thank you.